occupied, but I can't keep driving. I thought about suggesting we camp in the truck, but we had no good way to heat it other than running the engine, and the gas gauge had already dipped under a quarter tank. I muscled the wheel into a turn at the driveway. The truck lurched, sinking into the snow, but the four rear wheels of the Deuce got enough traction to keep pushing us forward. I didn't have to use the brake to stop us. With the flat tire and packed snow, the truck simply coasted to a groaning stop after I let off the gas. The farmstead was silent. I thought I smelled a faint whiff of smoke. There were no other signs of habitation. I eased open my door. "Stay here," I said. "If you see anything, yell or come get me." Alyssa nodded. I pulled the pistol off my belt, holding it in my left hand, and slipped out of the truck. The flat tire had shredded, losing most of its tread. Some of the rubber had melted onto the wheel well. Maybe that accounted for the smoke I smelled. I stalked to the back door. The snow on the walk was packed to icy solidity. My exhaustion vanished, replaced by an adrenaline-fueled buzz. I swiveled my head back and forth, totally alert, looking, listening, smelling, even tasting the air. There was a lean-to addition on the back of the house. Only 4 inches or so of snow were on the roof. Someone had cleared it off after last year's blizzards. A skylight, slightly off-center, pierced the shingles. A round piece of metal covered the center of the skylight, as though someone had patched it. The snow had melted for a foot or so all around the skylight, which meant there was, or had been, a heat source inside. The storm door was open and askew. Its top hinge had been ripped away. The entry door seemed solid, though. I took hold of the knob, slowly twisting it. The door was unlocked. I pushed it open. Inside, there was a small mudroom. An ancient freezer sat in one corner, redundant because the room itself was below freezing, and useless because there was no hum of power. A pile of filthy, frozen clothing occupied another corner. Aside from that, the room was empty. The next room was a large kitchen. I could tell it had been a kitchen by the pipes protruding from the walls and the outlines in the paint showing where cabinets had once hung. A thick, 3-foot-square chunk of foam board insulation lay on the floor. Someone had laid a double stack of concrete patio pavers on it, and ashes from an old fire were clumped atop the pavers. A huge jumble of branches was heaped in one corner. The patched skylight was directly above the makeshift fire pit. A long string with a loop tied in the end dangled from the metal patch. I tugged on the string experimentally. The patch proved to be a metal cover on a spring-loaded hinge. When I pulled it fully open, the loop in the string would just reach a nail jutting from the wall. It was an ingenious setup. You could open the hatch to let smoke out or close it to keep heat in, all without having to reach the high, sloped ceiling. People had clearly been living here since the eruption. The only question? Were they still here? I eased through the entire house, quietly checking every room. Some held furniture and belongings, but much of what I found was broken, ruined, or frozen. I saw lots of signs that people had lived here, but none that they'd been around recently. Where had they gone? And why? I even investigated the basement, returning to the truck to get a candle so I could peer into the dark corners around the dead furnace. This place was abandoned. I went back outside to get the others. The truck was on the opposite side of the house from the road. Not exactly hidden, but it was the best I could do. When I tried to help Ben out of the truck, Alyssa waved me away. It didn't seem like she helped him much, just offered a shoulder that he leaned on for support as they trudged inside. I built a fire in the kitchen while Alyssa unwrapped Ben's ankle and struggled to take off his boot. His ankle was hugely swollen and red. We weren't sure how to tell if it was broken, so we decided to rewrap it for support but leave his boot off. We probably couldn't have gotten it back on him anyway. I searched Clevis's pack. He had a couple of 2-liter plastic bottles full of water that had stayed liquid, warmed by the heater in the truck. a bundle of corn pone wrapped in paper, a plastic bag filled with dried meat, a few matches, and a small first aid kit. I tossed the meat into the snow outside. No way would I eat meat that came from a Flenser's backpack. Alyssa filled one of my pans with snow and put it on the fire to melt. Ben asked to use my hatchet. I handed it over, and he crawled to the woodpile and started breaking up the branches, sorting them by size. I was starving, so I worked on lunch. Cornmeal mush with dandelion greens and bits of beef jerky, my gourmet specialty. While I worked, I tried to find out more about Alyssa. How long have you two been with the Peckerwoods? Ben Slage, you mean? Alyssa said. Almost 4 months. Why'd they keep you around? I wanted to ask why the Peckerwoods hadn't killed and eaten them both, but that hardly seemed polite. I did stuff for them. Alyssa wrapped her arms around her chest, hugging herself. Stuff? Like what? Alyssa's face turned red, but judging from her expression, she was angry, not embarrassed. Like none of your business. Oh, that kind of stuff. Suddenly I thought of Darla, held captive by the same men. I choked my words out through grinding teeth. Sorry, and Ben? I told Danny I'd kill myself if he hurt Ben, and I convinced him that he didn't want me to kill myself. Alyssa's face was cold, hard, and red as a brick. But he was sending you to Iowa City? The Peckerwoods are running out of food and gas. I guess they got a good price for me. Alyssa shrugged. And Danny has a new girl he got from the Peckerwoods in Cascade. He likes short brunettes. Guess she's that Darla you told me about. My face grew hot, and I ground my teeth with fury. I thrust my hand into my pocket, gripping the chain until it cut my fingers. I had to get moving. Had to get back to Anamosa. Had to find Darla. Chapter 55. Alyssa backed up a step, eyeing me warily.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. It didn't look like she was hurt too bad.
What'll they do to her? I wasn't sure I wanted to know. Alyssa shied away from me.
Nothing good.
I've got to get back to Anamosa. I started to push myself upright, but made the mistake of trying to use my right arm. Pain reverberated through my arm and chest, and I crumpled, falling alongside the fire. Alyssa knelt beside me and pulled off my right glove.
Why do you want to get killed over her? Who is she?
Darla, she's my... Girlfriend didn't seem to cover it. I struggled to think of a word that did. She's the reason I'm alive. Alyssa nodded.
The only reason I'm alive is Ben. When I told Danny that I'd starve myself to death if he flensed Ben, I meant it. There's nothing in this shit pool life worth living for except him.
She started to strip off my jacket, forcing me to sit up. I tried to protest, but she shushed me and kept on going, taking off my clothing until I was bare-chested by the fire. I pushed a couple more sticks of wood into the fire. My back was freezing.
Wow,
Alyssa said, looking at my right arm. It was a swollen mass of purple-blue bruises. She gently lifted my arm. Even my armpit was bruised. Alyssa ran her fingers lightly over the horseshoe-shaped scar at the base of my ribcage.
What's that from?
A bandit, Flenser, I guess, got me with a hatchet last year.
And you survived?
I killed him, I said flatly.
And those?
She touched one of the round scabs on my belly. Shotgun pellets. Her fingers wandered to my chest, tracing my pecs, which had gotten considerably larger over the months of non-stop farm work and physically challenging lifestyle, to put it mildly.
You're strong, she said.
I pulled away from her fingers and reached out to stir the corn porridge. It's ready.
I'm not sure what to do about your arm. It doesn't seem like anything's broken. I shrugged my left shoulder. Maybe I should strap it to your side, or make a sling. It might heal faster if you can't move it. No, I said. I can move it a little. If anything happens, I might need it. Just help me put my clothes back on. She didn't respond right away. She was staring at me, at the bruises on my arm, maybe, or maybe at my chest. Her eyes weren't on my face, that was for sure. I wasn't used to having a girl look at me that way. Well, Darla had sometimes. I picked up my T-shirt and held it out toward her. If you go back to Anamosa, you're gonna die. There's more than 100 Peckerwoods there, she said as she helped me struggle into my T-shirt. Darla needs me. She'll be, well, they won't kill her. She's young and pretty, valuable. They can't have her. I'm going to go get her. I'd leave now if I could. Alyssa's eyes shone in the firelight. Hey, I'll just get close. Then you and Ben can have the truck. Drive yourselves to Worthington. You'll be safe there. Alyssa started softly crying. I looked at Ben. He was immersed in systematically chopping and sorting wood, oblivious to his sister. I reached out and wrapped an arm around her, drawing her into an awkward, one-armed hug. Hey, it's okay. You'll be all right now, I told her. She clung to me. Her tears ran down my shoulder, and her arm hurt me where it pressed against my bruises. She smelled musky, salty, exciting somehow. Her scent reminded me of Darla. Suddenly I was crying, too. We held on to each other for a minute. Then I smelled something burning. I broke our hug and snatched the pot off the fire. Alyssa helped me get dressed while our lunch cooled. We ate all the corn mush, even the burnt bits. I was utterly exhausted. I asked Alyssa to keep watch, tucked a pair of pants under my head, and fell asleep, curled in front of the fire. Chapter 56. When I awoke, Alyssa was up, cooking corn porridge for breakfast while Ben tended the fire. "Why didn't you wake me up to take a turn on watch?" I asked. "There was no need," she said. "You stayed up all night? You want to sleep now?" "No, I couldn't stay up. Somebody should have kept watch." "Nothing happened," she replied. I grunted, mildly disgusted, but unwilling to continue arguing. After breakfast, I struggled to my feet. "I'm going to check the barn." "You could barely move," Alyssa protested. "There might be something useful out there, maybe a jack." I took a faltering step toward the door. Alyssa got up and tucked herself under my left shoulder. "I'll help." "Shouldn't you stay with Ben?" "He's fine." We stumbled outside with my arms slung over her shoulders for support. A rusted tractor sat in the center of the barn. In one corner, there was a huge pile of brown and yellow corn husks, useless except to feed goats or pigs. On the way back, I looked into the bed of our truck. The wooden crates were a jumbled mess. "What's in the crates?" I asked. "I don't know," Alyssa answered. "The Peckerwoods loaded them before they loaded us." "Help me get up there." Alyssa let down the tailgate and boosted me up. I hacked at the nearest crate with my hatchet. Opening it one-handed proved to be difficult. I struggled fruitlessly for 15 or 20 minutes. Finally, I got the blade of the hatchet jammed under the lid and used the handle as a lever. Inside, it was full of steel chains. I picked one up. It was really four chains with manacles attached, identical to the set Ben had been wearing. The key was affixed to one of the manacles with a strip of duct tape. I hacked open another box. It was packed with neat rows of identical brown paperboard boxes. I opened the flap of one at random. Gleaming rows of brass shotgun shells stacked upright filled the box. There must have been 100 shells in that one box, thousands in the whole crate. "Too bad I lost the shotgun," I said. "Anyway, I guess we're rich." "Those are worth a lot?" Alyssa asked. "Yeah, a fortune, if we can find someone to trade with.
I was hoping the barn would have something we could use as a jack and maybe a wrench.
Can't we just drive real slow?
Yeah, but it would take all day to get to Worthington that way. You'd run out of gas.
Oh,
maybe we can cut a beam out of the barn, use it as a lever to lift up one side of the truck and block it up.
Will that work?
I don't know. I don't see any way to test it right now, as beat up as I am.
I wish Darla were here. She'd know how to do it.
She was good with trucks?
Yeah,
she's a wizard with any kind of machine. I turned from Alyssa to hide the trembling in my lip.
She'll be okay. The Peckerwoods, well, the crazy ones, the most brutal ones, they're already dead. The guys that are left, some of them are plenty nasty, but they're smart, too. They won't kill her. They won't destroy something that has value.
Something. That word sparked my fury. It filled me like the deep breath you take before a scream. But the Peckerwoods weren't Alyssa's fault. She hadn't created this ash-cursed world. I swallowed on my anger.
You're not really helping, I said as mildly as I could manage.
Oh, sorry. We spent the rest of the day cooking, eating, and resting. Just the short walk out to the barn and truck had left me exhausted, and I couldn't do anything but sleep. The weakness in my body infuriated me. Darla might be suffering far worse than I, but there was nothing I could do about it. I'd abused my body so badly that I couldn't keep going, no matter how much I wanted to. I was completely out of gas. After dinner, I offered to take the first watch while Alyssa and Ben slept. After waking up completely unguarded the night before, I didn't trust either of them to do it. As they arranged themselves around the fire to sleep, I wondered how I was going to know when to wake up Alyssa. In the past, sometimes I'd paced, counting steps, and estimating time that way. Now, I was too weak to pace. I started counting slowly on my fingers, trying to time a second per finger. As I tapped my pinky against the floor, a nursery rhyme came to my mind, unbidden. This little piggy went to market, this little piggy stayed home. I started muttering the rhyme instead of counting. Reciting the nursery rhyme brought my mother to mind. She used to sing-song it with my sister and me, grabbing our toes and wiggling them with each line of the poem. In my worry for Darla, I'd almost forgotten about Mom and Dad. They were the reason we'd left Warren, the reason Darla got shot. Just a week ago, I'd been determined to find them. Now, leaving Warren seemed like a stupid idea, the dumbest thing I'd ever done. Maybe 10 seconds passed each time I said the rhyme. 6 rhymes a minute. 360 mind-numbing rhymes an hour. 1,440 before I could wake Alyssa. I'd probably have nightmares about stupid little piggies. By the time I finished, I was speed mumbling, saying the rhyme in 7 or 8 seconds instead of 10. My fingers hurt from tapping the floor, but if anything, I hit it even harder. The pain helped me stay awake. I grabbed Alyssa's ankle and shook her. Your turn to keep watch.
Okay.
Alyssa slowly sat up. She'd taken off her coat to use as a pillow. The lavender sweater she wore underneath wasn't exactly form-fitting, but it looked good on her. I rummaged in my pack, looking for a pair of jeans to use as a pillow. Good night, I said, once I got settled. And please don't fall asleep. We need to stay safe.
You know, I never did thank you for rescuing us.
Alyssa squatted by my head, feeding the fire. I would have shrugged, but I was resting on my left shoulder, and my right hurt too badly.
I thought you were Darla. I think you would have helped us anyway.
Maybe so. Alyssa put a hand on my shoulder, and I winced.
Oh, sorry, I forgot.
Her hand wandered up to my neck.
It's okay. Good night.
How did you beat Clevis? And learn to climb around on moving trucks like an action movie star? Her hand caressed my cheek. I wasn't sure how to feel about her touch. My mind was annoyed and wanted to sleep, but at the same time,
It felt somehow reassuring, and maybe something else, too. I've been training in Taekwondo since I was 5, although we never practiced climbing around on a moving truck, that's true. You could, you know, come to Worthington with Ben and me. Alyssa was whispering, bent over me so our faces were close. I can't. She kissed me. I knew it was wrong, was appalled with myself, but I still returned her kiss, my lips open, drinking in her hypnotic softness. I rolled away onto my back, which Alyssa took as a sign of encouragement, kissing me more fiercely, her hands busy at my chest, spreading the warmth from my lips down toward my groin. I pushed her away. No. Why not? I could make you happy. No. You could make me feel good. Not happy. There's a difference. Most of the guys I've met don't think so. I shrugged. Her face scrunched as if in pain. You're just going to get yourself killed chasing after her. Probably. I rolled back onto my side and stared into the fire, waiting for the tempestuous mix of regret, desire, and shame to subside. Alyssa was silent, staring at me. I closed my eyes and waited for sleep to take me. I dreamed of pigs. A hog squealed as Darla slashed its throat. Blood fountained out as the pig cried, sounding exactly like my sister in the midst of a full-blown temper tantrum. Darla's arms and face were splashed, dripping red in my candlelit dream. She smiled and seemed to see me. Her head turned and her sanguinary visage shifted, her mouth open and a little low, eyes wide with pain and betrayal. Then the dream shifted and suddenly Darla was naked, suffocatingly beautiful. Her arms and face were still covered in blood. She drew a finger through the blood, painting herself, writhing suggestively and whispering, "Alex, Alex." I woke up. Alyssa was spooned against my back, her arm resting on my shoulder, which hurt. On the other side of the fire, less than 10 feet from me, a strange man stood, aiming a rifle at my chest. Chapter 57. The man was lean and grizzled, his scraggly beard frosted white. His brown Carhartt coveralls were filthy, as if he'd been sleeping on dirt. I pinched Alyssa's hand, and she startled awake. "Nice job keeping watch," I hissed. "Sorry," she whispered back. The man growled, "Don't move. Take that knife and gun off his belt, Brand." I rotated my head to see who he was talking to. About 5 feet behind me stood a woman clutching a silver revolver in a two-handed grip, pointing it at Alyssa's back. A boy, maybe 12 or 13 years old, stood next to her. He stepped over to where Alyssa and I lay and bent to take my knife and pistol. His hands were shaking so badly I was afraid he'd cut me with my own knife. He retreated to stand beside the woman. Ben sat up. I hadn't even realized he was awake. The man swiveled, pointing his rifle at Ben. "I said, don't move." "Your tactical doctrine is flawed," Ben said. The man gaped. "In a 3-person team, optimal tactical doctrine calls for enveloping the target in a triangular formation." "Just don't move, okay?" the man said. "If the sister unit or her attachment stood up, you'd be in each other's field of fire. If you missed or just grazed your target, you could easily wind up shooting one of your team members." "Her attachment? Me? And what was he doing lecturing these people about infantry tactics?" "Shut him up," I hissed at Alyssa. "Like I could," she whispered back. Ben kept talking. "With a Winchester Model 70 at a range of 12 feet, even a hit might pass through the target and impact a team member." The man looked down at his rifle, clearly surprised. "Fixing your deployment would be easy. You, short one," Ben said, addressing the kid. "Move over here, on the other side of me." Great, I thought. Now he's telling people how to kill us more effectively. To my amazement, the boy did it, moving away from the woman. "No, farther away," Ben said,
so you can't be used as a shield or hostage easily." The boy took 2 steps back. "Now you," Ben said to the woman, "take 3 big steps to your right." She started to turn. "No," Ben said, "sidestep, so your weapon stays on the target." The woman sidestepped so that now the 3 of them formed a neat triangle around us. "Good," Ben said. "Now, if you discharge your weapons, each of you will have a clear field of fire. This formation is not recommended in situations where there is a risk of encountering flanking forces. In that situation, an enfilade deployment is preferable." Ben kept talking about the benefits and drawbacks of an enfilade deployment, whatever that was. The man's mouth formed an O, probably because it couldn't very well form the letters WTF. The situation was so ridiculous and tense that I couldn't help myself. I started laughing. Everyone looked at me like I was crazy, which was fair, I guessed. Then the man holding the rifle started laughing too, and pretty soon everyone but Ben had joined in. When the hilarity had died down, the man said, "You all are just crazy enough that I think I understand why you're still alive." "Yeah," I said. I pushed myself slowly upright, keeping both hands in view. Maybe this guy was laughing, but he still had a rifle pointed my way. I took a step closer to him and stretched my left hand out as if to shake. My right arm still wasn't working too well. He snicked the safety on and moved the rifle to his shoulder, pointed upward. His handshake was a little too vigorous for my liking. I could move my left arm, but it still hurt when he pumped it. "I'm Eli. My wife there's Mary Sue, and that's my son, Brand." He was so dirty he left a smudge on my hand. Not that my own hands were any too clean. "What's wrong with him?" Brand said, looking at Ben. "Nothing's wrong with him," Alyssa snapped as she stood up. "He's autistic," I said. "He doesn't seem artistic," Brand replied. Alyssa wasn't smiling. "Autistic! And he's smarter than everyone else in this room put together." "Sorry," Brand muttered. Ben was ignoring us all, sketching something with his fingertip in the dust on the floor. More infantry tactics, maybe. I still felt as if I were inching along the edge of a 100-foot cliff. There were no guns pointed at us now, but they were still armed, and we weren't. "Can I have my stuff back?" I asked Brand. He looked at his father, who shook his head. "You all weren't planning on staying here, were ya?" Mary Sue said, the first words she'd uttered. Her voice brought to mind the sibilant whisper of a moving snake. "We're headed to Worthington," Alyssa said. "Huh, probably nothing there. Morley, Olin, and Mechanicsville all been ransacked. Not a living soul in any of them. No dead people either, unless you count bones already cracked and sucked dry of their marrow. We visited, hoping to trade." Mary Sue stepped closer to us as she talked. Her teeth shone yellow in the firelight. Each tooth was outlined in blood. "Worthington was fine a week ago," I said. "Your gums are bleeding. You have scurvy?"
"Yeah, no fresh food. Girls got it worse."
"Girls?" Alyssa said.
"Alba and Joy," Mary Sue said. "They're safe, hidden."
I rummaged through my pack. Eli readied his rifle, eyeing me suspiciously. I was running low on dandelion leaves, and the ones I had left were pretty badly wilted. As I pulled a bag out of my backpack, Eli aimed the rifle at me again and muttered, "Easy." "It's okay. I'm just getting dandelion leaves." I handed the bag to Mary Sue. "They're bitter, but they have vitamin C. That's all I have left." She pulled a leaf out of the bag and bit it.
"Fresh greens. Didn't think I'd live to taste them again. Where'd you get them?"
She whispered the question as if she were asking where I'd learned the secret nature of God, not where I'd picked up some weeds. "Worthington, they grow 'em in cold frames." "You got any seeds?" Eli lowered his rifle. "We could make cold frames out of some of our windows."
"Yeah, that's how they do it in Worthington. I don't have any dandelion seeds, but I can do you one better. I've got kale seeds.
Good winter variety. It can even come back from a freeze if it isn't too hard or too long. 4 times as much vitamin C as dandelion. And where'd that miracle come from? Warren, Illinois. It's home now, I guess. We grow kale in greenhouses. I reached into my jacket and pulled open the bag in my pocket without taking it out. I didn't want them to see how many packets of kale seeds I had. I slid out one envelope. Eli accepted the envelope I offered him.
You came all the way from Illinois?
Yeah. Now, can I have my weapons back? Eli nodded slowly.
Brand, give the man his gun and knife and then fetch your sisters from the cellar.
He set his rifle aside and fed the fire. The girls were both younger than Brand. They reminded me of a bed of spring wildflowers I'd seen once after a flood. You could tell they were beautiful, even if they were beaten down and coated in filth. Mary Sue carefully split the dandelion leaves into 5 portions. I noticed that Eli got less than the kids, and Mary Sue got barely any at all. While they ate, we traded stories. I told the saga of my trip from Illinois, how we'd found the shotgun, Blue Betsy, that had spurred this crazy trip to find my parents, losing Bikezilla in the Mississippi. I choked on my words as I told them about Darla getting shot. When I finished, Eli said,
"Used to have a lot of trouble with the Peckerwoods ourselves. Had one visit from another gang, called themselves the Dirty White Boys. Haven't seen either of them in about 2 months. Figured they'd run out of gas."
How'd you survive a visit from the Peckerwoods?
Same way we did when you came. Hid in the root cellar. Could hear them shouting and carousing upstairs. We keep everything important down there so we can hide at a moment's notice. Speaking of which, we'd best post a lookout again. Alba, it's your turn.
"Yes, Poppy," she said in her little girl soprano as she hurried away.
"You've been down there for 2 days? I checked the basement. I didn't see any root cellar."
"We moved the furnace to block the door. And yeah, we would have stayed down there until you left, but one of the dang pigs got out last night."
"You keep pigs down there?"
"Can't keep them up here, can we? Anyone comes, that'd give us away for sure. Plus, we'd lose valuable food. Anyway, I figured the stupid thing would wake you up, so we came up here loaded for bear and found you all hibernating."
"How'd you keep the pigs quiet?"
"Well, we didn't, did we? Used to feed them NyQuil, but we're out." I glared at Alyssa.
"I already said I was sorry."
I turned back to Eli.
"You haven't slaughtered the pigs for meat?"
"I'm saving a few to breed when things start to turn around."
"What do you feed them?"
"Corn and soybeans. All the farms around here are abandoned. There's more crops left under the snow and ash than we can dig up."
I shook my head in amazement. Not only were they surviving, they were preparing for a post-eruption future.
Eli was staring at me in a thoughtful way. He turned towards his wife.
"You know, we could use more hands. Especially if we gotta try farming kale."
"I'm not staying," I said. "I'm going after Darla."
"Going up against those gangs will get you killed in a hurry."
I shrugged. Eli turned his gaze toward Alyssa. "She can't stay. Not on her own some," Mary Sue hissed at him.
"I'm trying to get to Worthington," Alyssa said.
"We just need to get the tire on our truck changed and we'll be on our way.
You got a jack here?"
"Buried out in the shed, yeah. Might take days to dig it out, though."
"Crap, I need to get moving."
"Could probably rig something up, do the same work as a jack. Some levers and blocks, maybe."
"Sounds good.
How are you paying for the work?"
Kale seeds?
"That's your rent money for staying here. What else you got?"
I thought for a moment.
"There's some crates in the back of the truck. We only opened 2 of them, but one of them had shotgun shells in it. You get the tire changed and I'll split the truck's load 50-50 with you. Ammo's worth a fortune if you can find someone to trade with."
Mary Sue cupped her hands around Eli's ear, whispering something. He recoiled from her, a growl rattling from his throat.
"We do that? We ain't no better than the Peckerwoods." I watched them carefully, looking away only when Mary Sue shot me a murderous glare. Why was she hating on me? I hadn't done anything. Getting the truck jacked up and the tire changed took most of the day. First, we had to bend the wheel well away from the tire using a wrecking bar Eli provided. We made a long, heavy lever out of a pair of 2x10 rafters scavenged from the barn. Then we spent hours digging up patio pavers from the frozen ground at the back of the house to use as a fulcrum and blocks. Improvising a makeshift tire iron was much easier. We used an adjustable wrench and a length of galvanized iron pipe cut from the basement. We still had to actually jack up the truck. We wedged our lever under the truck just behind the blown wheel and stacked pavers under it to use as a fulcrum. More than 12 feet of the lever protruded from under the truck, angled upward so steeply we had to reach above our heads to grab it. Using the lever, Eli, Ben, and I could raise the corner of the truck by ourselves, even though I was only using my left arm. We couldn't raise it very far, though. Brand rushed to stack pavers under the truck. Then we let the truck back down and reset our fulcrum to lift it again. It took 7 or 8 lifts to finally get the truck high enough to swap the tires. Then we had to lift the truck again while Brand cleared all the blocks out from under it. "You ready to split up the load?" Eli said. "Yeah." I helped him drag the wooden crates out of the truck's load bed. We stacked the crates on the packed snow outside. As I went to move one of the last crates out of the back of the truck, something shifted, and I heard a metallic clunk. Something had been buried under the pile of crates. I couldn't see exactly what it was, so I grabbed it and carried it out into the light. "Son of a mangy coyote bitch," Eli said when he saw what I was holding. Then we started laughing. I held the truck's hydraulic jack and tire iron. Instead of stowing the jack in the toolbox, the Peckerwoods had just tossed it in the load bed. 4 of the crates held manacles. All the rest were loaded with ammo. We split everything down the middle, as agreed, although that probably made it the most fabulously expensive tire change in history. Unfortunately, it was all rifle and shotgun loads, and all I had was a pistol. That gave me an idea. "You got any long guns I could trade for?" "No way," Eli replied. "Just got the rifle and revolver you already saw. Can't afford to give either of them up, not for any price." So much for that idea. We resealed all the crates. I didn't want the ammo flying everywhere if we hit a pothole or something. By that time, the dim daylight was fading to night. We'd have to wait till morning to leave. Navigating unknown roads in a truck I could barely drive would be impossible in the pitch-black, post-volcanic night. My anxiety increased with every day that passed, every day that Darla had to endure the Peckerwoods. Chapter 58. I woke with a start. Something had touched my head. I slept using my backpack as a pillow. Now, by the light cast by the embers of our fire, I saw the pale gleam of an arm being withdrawn from my pack. I whipped out my left arm, caught the intruding arm, and twisted. I heard a high-pitched moan as I forced the intruder's arm behind her back, bringing her to the floor with a thump. I rolled over onto her, controlling her legs with mine. They weren't really Taekwondo moves, but we had practiced ground fighting occasionally at my dojang. I leaned down and whispered in her ear, lacing my words with sarcasm. "You needed something for my pack?"
"I know you got more of them greens," Mary Sue replied.
"I don't, and if I catch you in my backpack again, I'll break your arm." I forced her wrist toward her neck, emphasizing just how easy it would be to break her arm in this position. Mary Sue whimpered quietly. I let go of her wrist and rolled off of her. Mary Sue crawled away. Ben and Alyssa hadn't even woken up. Mary Sue's enmity didn't make any sense to me. I'd given her dandelion greens, kale seeds, and ammo. Maybe it was a case of Mama Tiger gone rogue. I lay awake for an hour or more, wondering if she would return and force me to make good on my threat. To my relief, she never did. I woke with the dawn. It took us less than 10 minutes to get packed. Eli offered to make us breakfast, but I declined. I didn't want to spend any more time than I had to in close proximity to his wife. He and Bran said goodbye, clasping arms with me and Alyssa. Ben was already in the truck. Mary Sue wouldn't even meet my eyes, and the girls were too shy to shake our hands or offer hugs. "Come back anytime," Eli said as I climbed into the truck. "I will," I lied. The scowl on Mary Sue's face told me exactly how welcome I'd be if I ever showed up again. I slammed the door, pushed the starter, and stalled the truck. Not my proudest moment. But on the second try, I found first gear, and we rolled away from the farmstead, headed east. I planned to turn north at the first opportunity and loop back to Anamosa. Hopefully, there'd be enough gas for Alyssa and Ben to get to Worthington after I left them. Less than a quarter tank remained. Maybe it'd be enough. I'd driven about a half an hour when we approached a small town. A sign barely protruding from the snowbank read, "Welcome to Olin." I drove down the abandoned and burned-out main street. The highway ended in a T on the far side of town, and a short knoll rose in the field to the left of the road. I slowed as I neared the intersection, looking for street signs. Without warning, a telephone pole toppled in front of us. I stomped on the brakes, sliding to a stop well before the intersection. The pole had slammed into the snow berm just ahead of us, so it was perched about 4 feet above the road, completely blocking our passage. I struggled to throw the truck into reverse, but I was so freaked out that I stalled it again. It didn't matter. In the rearview mirror, I saw another telephone pole topple behind us, boxing us in. The worst part? A line of 9 or 10 men appeared at the top of the knoll, bellies in the snow, aiming rifles right down at us. Chapter 59. "Get down!" I yelled as I ducked below the driver's window. I figured they'd start shooting. But instead, I heard a voice amplified through a bullhorn. "Turn off your vehicle. Place your hands on the dashboard. Resistance will be met with deadly force." Well, duh. I'd already stalled the vehicle. Alyssa crouched in the passenger footwell, and Ben bent over so he was mostly behind a dash. Alyssa looked scared. Ben looked about the same as he always looked, a little bit detached. "You must comply or we will open fire," the voice boomed. 10, 9. "Can we get out the passenger side?" I whispered. "Their tactical position is excellent," Ben replied. "We could take cover on the opposite side of the truck, but if we climb the snow pile or move down the road in either direction, we'll enter their field of fire." I thought about trying to restart the truck and using it to ram the telephone pole. But they were only 30 or 40 feet away, and they were above us. Would the truck's roof stop a rifle shot from that close? I didn't think so. As the voice counted, 3, 2... I got out of the footwell, leaned forward to lay my hands on the dashboard, and told Alyssa and Ben to do the same. 4 of them detached from the troop, sliding down the knoll toward us. They wore white and gray military camo, the first people I'd seen who had the perfect camouflage to hide in the volcanic winter. When they reached me, the nearest one wrenched open the driver's door while another guy trained his rifle on my head. One of them searched me, efficiently and none too gently, but he took only the knife and pistol off my belt. The patch on his chest read Blacklake LLC. I stifled a groan. No way did I want to repeat my experience with Blacklake, locked in one of the camps they ran as a subcontractor for FEMA. But it wasn't like I had much choice. On the other side of the truck, 2 guys were dealing with Ben and Alyssa the same way. Ben started moaning, and Alyssa tried to comfort him, but there wasn't much she could do. "Hands behind your back," the guy ordered. When I complied, he slipped plastic ties around my wrists and cinched them tight. My right arm didn't like being held behind my back and wasn't shy about telling me so. I quickly had spasms of pain shooting toward my neck. I grunted as they pulled me out of the truck. Alyssa, Ben, and I stood together, watching a short, pudgy Blacklake guy work his way around the edge of the knoll toward us. He was the only one not carrying an assault rifle, although he had a pistol on his belt.
"What do we got, Flensers?" he asked as he approached.
He unsnapped the leather strap that held his pistol in its holster, and the other four Blacklake guys took a step back, away from us.
"We're not Flensers," I said.
"Looks like a Flenser truck, one of the old model deuces we were using till the Flensers raided our Dubuque depot."
One of the guys with the assault rifle snorted, and Pudge silenced him with a glare.
"I took the truck from the Peckerwoods. Crashed it. See the windshield?"
It would have been hard to miss with the hole punched in the passenger side and long spiderweb cracks radiating out across the glass. I hadn't cleaned the blood off the inside of it either.
"Yeah," Pudge turned toward one of the grunts. "You search it yet? Any flesh on board?"
"No, sir."
"Do it now."
"Yes, sir."
Two of the grunts trotted to the back of the truck. I stood with Alyssa and Ben, shifting my weight from foot to foot, waiting. Nails screeched from within the truck as they forced the wooden crates open. Pudge stared at me and fingered his pistol, a greedy look in his eye. The other Blacklake guys had left the crest of the knoll. They were using a hand winch to crank one of the telephone poles back into place. It was affixed to its base with a huge hinge and held up by guy wires. Obviously, they'd prepared the spot as a trap long ago and planned to use it again.
"Ammo and manacles," one of the grunts reported when they returned from inside our truck.
A disappointed look passed across Pudge's face. He snapped his holster strap shut.
"Davis, Roberts, follow us in the captured vehicle. Phelps, Miner, load the prisoners."
I guess that meant us. Two of the guys led us to the far side of the knoll where a cargo truck was parked. It was tall and armored, looking something like an oversized elephant with stubby legs. The Blacklake grunts lifted us into the enclosed cargo bed. The door closed behind us with a resounding clang.
Chapter 60. A sparse light filtered through the small grate at the top of the cargo hold. When my eyes adjusted, I saw the area was bare except for a metal bench on either side. The truck roared to life, and I sat down with a lurch. Ben was moaning, rocking back and forth. Alyssa talked to him, her voice inhumanly calm, considering that we'd just been tossed into the back of a cargo truck. I wanted to yell in frustration, but I knew it wouldn't do any good. After about 10 minutes, Ben quieted. I tried to explain to Alyssa and Ben what I thought was happening. We were being taken to a camp, I figured, like the one Darla and I had done time in last year. Blacklake got paid by FEMA according to the number of refugees they housed, so they scoured the countryside looking for people to capture and move into their camps. I wondered how Blacklake got paid. Dollars were worthless in Iowa and Illinois now. We had to trade for anything we needed. What would a big corporation want in trade? I couldn't guess. Alyssa seemed to take it in stride. I suppose after you've been enslaved by a cannibal gang, anything else seems okay by comparison. I roamed around the truck's cargo hold looking for a way out. The hold was solid and made of metal, and the doors were securely locked. We were only on the road for a half an hour. Then we were herded into a dingy makeshift room built inside an abandoned Walmart. A battered metal desk sat directly under a skylight, which let in what little light there was. Two guards lounged in cheap plastic lawn chairs, and a bored-looking guy, Captain Alverman, according to the cloth strip sewn on his fatigues, wrote on old sheets of copy paper. One of the guards searched us. I had a brief moment of panic when he patted my chest, feeling the pockets that held my kale and wheat, but the packages must have been soft enough not to arouse suspicion. He didn't investigate further. Other than that, we had nothing to take. My backpack was still in the truck we'd taken from the Peckerwoods. As far as I knew, Alyssa and Ben had only the clothes on their backs. Captain Alverman interviewed us in a bored, monotone voice, jotting our names in tiny handwriting on a sheet of copy paper already packed with names. I remembered the printed list of refugees' names Rita May had shown me. Now, there were no computers or printers visible. Evidently, things were getting worse.
even for Black Lake. When Alverman finished, his guards escorted us out the front of the Walmart. On the far side of the road, there was a huge enclosure built from chain-link fence. It stretched so far in either direction that I couldn't see the whole thing. It was easily as big as Camp Galena had been, and that place had held almost 50,000 people. The fence was 12 feet high, not counting the coil of razor wire topping it. It looked identical to the fence Black Lake had built at Camp Galena, the one Darla had pretty much destroyed with a bulldozer as we escaped. I would never have escaped that camp by myself. But this time, I was on my own. As we got closer, I saw a pair of guards patrolling a well-worn path in the snow around the outside of the fence. Each of them carried an assault rifle. We approached a tiny guard shack just outside a gate. One of our guards got a key from the guy in the shack and unlocked the gate. Another cut the plastic handcuffs off of us and pushed us through. I rubbed my right arm, trying to work the painful kinks out of my shoulder. Uneven rows of tents stretched out across the camp before us. Some of the canvas tents were like the ones in Camp Galena last year, but these seemed dirtier, more ragged. Many of them bore makeshift patches made with scraps of plastic. None of them rested on platforms, and I knew from experience how cold the frozen ground would be. And not everyone had a real tent. Some of the shelters were just chunks of plastic propped up on sticks. I saw a few that weren't even plastic, instead made of old bedspreads. I guess they'd at least keep the wind out. Hundreds of people were visible, talking in small groups or milling around. Thousands more must have been huddled in their tents, trying to escape the bitter wind. Before we could figure out what to do, an Asian kid who looked to be about 12 broke away from a group nearby and strode up to us. Well, up to Alyssa. He raked his eyes up and down her. Not that there was much to see. She was bundled in winter clothes like everyone else. But the clothing and dirt somehow didn't dim her beauty, just cloaked it. "Welcome to Camp Makokada," the kid said. The name of the camp rocketed through my mind. My parents might be here. How would I find them amid this multitude? "You need to go to the principal's office, girlie." "The principal?" The kid gave me an annoyed look. "Not you, her. She's so hot I can warm my hands off of her." He held out his gloved hands and rubbed them as if he were in front of a campfire. I started to step between him and Alyssa, but she held me back with a hand on my arm. "That's so sweet," Alyssa said in a syrupy voice. "What's your name?" "Flash, the, shaken and stirred. At your service, girlie." Alyssa took one of his hands in hers. "Nice to meet you, Flash. My name's Alyssa. What do you mean, the principal's office?" I eyed Flash. He didn't seem to be a threat, but maybe he was working with someone else. Ben was completely absorbed in watching the two guards as they patrolled outside the fence. He was mumbling something too quietly for me to understand. Flash had a goofy grin on his face. The hand Alyssa held was visibly shaking with excitement. He still hadn't answered her question. "Who's the principal?" she said. "She looks after all the pretty girls, so they don't disappear." "Well, mostly they don't." "Disappear?" I asked. "Come with me," Flash said, still addressing Alyssa. "I'll show you around. Make introductions, as they say." He was totally butchering a James Bond accent. He started pulling on her hand, leading her toward the center of the camp. Alyssa and I followed him for about 10 feet, and then she stopped, pulling Flash to a halt as well. Ben hadn't moved. "Ben, come on," she yelled. He didn't hear or wouldn't respond, still absorbed in watching the guards. "Will you get him, please?" she asked me. I trotted back to him and reached out to touch him, pulling my hand back at the last moment. "Ben, Alyssa needs you." "The sister unit needs me," he replied. "The rule is that when the sister unit needs help, Ben helps. I will observe the guards later." He turned to follow me. Flash led Alyssa toward the middle of the camp. I hung back, watching, wary of an ambush. We crossed a wide cleared area, within which three rings of tents were pitched concentrically, like layers of an onion. At the center of these tents there was an open plaza, maybe 60 or 70 feet in diameter. The center area was packed with girls. Some were as young as 8 or 9. Some were older, women really, but none looked older than 30. They gathered in clusters, talking through the tent flaps, some of them huddled together for warmth. "What is?" "Ask the principal," Flash said. He pointed to the back of a woman kneeling in the doorway of one of the tents. She was easily the oldest person in view, her black hair halfway to steely gray. She looked like she couldn't be. Or could she? "Principal," Flash said. "The guards caught some fresh fish." The woman turned. "Woke?" Her word died as she locked eyes on mine. "Alex," she breathed. "Mom." Chapter 61. My world lit up despite the dim light, fired into technicolor brilliance by my joy. The last time I'd seen Mom, more than 10 months ago, we'd had a terrible fight. Sometimes, in my old life, I used to hate her. Now I couldn't imagine anything better than the elation coursing through me. She was alive, and I'd found her. Mom charged me, wrapping me in a hug so exuberant we were both knocked to our knees. The snow couldn't chill me. I was alight with the joy of seeing my mother again after 10 long months. I cried as we embraced. Neither of us could get out any words. Mom dragged her fingers across my face like a blind woman might, trying to feel my features. Her fingertips slid easily on my teary skin. I clutched at her back, balling up a fold of her coat in my fist, holding on as if to prevent her from ever slipping away again. "Principal," Flash said, "you okay?" Mom took a deep breath. "Yes, Lester, I'm better than okay." "I told you, don't call me Lester. The name is Flash." "This is Alex." She said my name as if it were an ineffable secret. "He's my son." "Principal?" I asked her. "That's just what they call me here." Mom hugged me even more tightly, hurting my injured shoulder. I must have let out a moan because she said, "You okay, Alex?" "Fine, it's just my shoulder." She loosened her grip. "What happened?" "A little truck accident. It's fine, really." "Let me see." I held her tightly as she tried to pull away. I never wanted to let go, despite the pain the embrace was causing me. "Alex, I need to know you're all right." "I'm fine," I said, but I loosened my grip on her anyway. Now that she was worried, I knew she wouldn't relax until she'd seen the damage for herself. She started stripping off my jacket and shirts. I thought about protesting, but really couldn't summon the energy. I was still in a happy daze. And truth be told, I kind of liked the mothering attention. "You look different, thinner, and stronger." I shrugged. "You too." I realized she hadn't said anything about Dad. I was scared to ask, afraid of what the answer might be. But I had to know. Mom, is Dad? Oh my gosh, I completely forgot. Lester, would you go get Doug? "It's Flash!" he yelled as he flitted away. By then, Mom had me stripped to the waist. The icy air made goosebumps rise all over my chest and arms. My right side was a beauty. Green, yellow, and purple bruises were splashed from my waist to my neck, covering my side and arm. "Good God," Mom whispered. "I'm okay." "Who was driving?" I couldn't think of an answer that would help. I just wanted to end the inquisition and get my clothing back on. I was freezing. I was on top of the truck the first time it crashed. You were... The other two crashes? Well, I was driving. She was momentarily speechless. "You are not allowed to drive on a learner's permit without me or Dad in the car, Alex." I gave her my best what-the-hell look. Like anyone cared about driver's licenses in the midst of all this chaos? "I think I lost my learner's permit when our house burned, Mom." "Our house? Never mind. What are those?" She pointed at the spots on my arms and belly where I'd been shot. It looked like they were healing okay. a bit puffy and red, but scabbed over nicely. Oh, that's where I got shot.
Shot? You got...
Look, Mom, a lot of stuff has happened since Darla and I set out to find you. Don't stress about